This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U-Mobile.
Good morning, you're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. The COVID-19 pandemic has not only claimed lives due to the virus, it has also extracted a mental health toll, evident from the increase in the number of suicides this year. On average, according to official statistics, there were 3 suicide deaths per day from January to May. And for all we know, that's just the tip of the iceberg. Previous research has shown that for every suicide death, there are 20 attempts. How do we ensure support for a more resilient society in the face of crisis? On World Suicide Prevention Day, we're discussing the policy responses needed to address the issue of suicide and bolster our support for the mental health care system. Joining me is YB Nurul Izzah Anwar, Member of Parliament for Permatang Pau. Izzah, good morning.
Thank you very much for having me. It's such an important day.
When we talk about the healthcare crisis that's caused by COVID-19, we can't ignore that it has morphed beyond simply the physical disease of the virus. I mean, the impact of the pandemic on mental health is arguably far more wide-ranging than the disease itself. From your observations in your constituency and the communities that you engage with, would you say that we're in a mental health emergency?
I think while many term the pandemic as a socioeconomic crisis, you can't run away that we're dealing with a serious mental health emergency. I always call it the hidden pandemic because you look at people who are suffering changes in their lives, whether they've lost someone due to COVID, whether they've lost their jobs, whether they've lost their work opportunities, their lifestyle. And I think the hidden dimension is the loss of control because you're dealing with something larger than life that's unknown and you can't predict what's going to happen next week, let alone 6 months into the future. And this has taken such a huge toll on people's mental health. And I see this because in our visits, of course, much more restricted than before. So the usual smiles that greet, or at least the time to sit down and have coffee, you know, that's not the new normal, right? The new normal is basically, you know, mask up. Sometimes you have to wear face shields. I mean, for those suffering from COVID, they have to be distanced from everyone else. So it really showcases the importance of providing support for their mental health. There's a lot more emotional turmoil that showcased to me. I you know, usually when during my visits, especially when we conducted the Multidimensional Poverty Index, we have enumerators who are themselves affected because the interviewees were really in such a difficult position, you know, mentally. There's mental anguish. So other than the numbers you cited, Shazana, I believe we do need to understand the implications and provide the necessary support, which is inclusive of giving them some degree of mental health or you know, tenacity to manage it accordingly.
I wanted to kind of recap what you said about the losses that we're dealing with during this pandemic. And I was really struck by that. The fact is the pandemic is, we're grieving, essentially. We're a society in grieving, whether it's the loss of loved ones, loss of life, or the loss of just a way of life that we used to know.
Yes.
And, you know, when we become mentally overwhelmed, I mean, suicide is too often the tragic culmination, especially when they're unable to get the help to alleviate this distress. Has the pandemic created more empathy in society, do you think, regarding the reasons that people die by suicide?
It's my belief that the pandemic should push governments, should push us, Malaysia, collectively to become far more compassionate, far more empathetic in our governance style, in our policy making, in our enabling, an environment that supports everyone. And, you know, that's why with the great uncertainty, it should push us to sort of become far more empathetic, to not just take this great opportunity through the pandemic, because it's actually exposed the deep vulnerabilities, the deep inequities that exist, not just within Malaysia, but externally as well. And one of the key steps is to decriminalize suicide, because you have to have clear, concrete action items rather than just the sweet buzzwords. And that will help at least showcase that kind of moral compass which people follow. And sort of, you know, you kind of give that vibe out. Mm-hmm. If not, it's like, you know, the rules are still stacked against those from lower income. And we're still utilizing the unfair rules in a situation where everyone, as you rightly pointed out, is grieving. Mm.
Coming to this issue of decriminalizing suicide, I mean, we are one of the very few countries that still sees suicide as a criminal act. There's been a long-running call by health advocates to decriminalize suicide in our legal system. From your vantage point in the Dewan Rakyat, how has this discussion progressed over the years?
I think, you know, we can see it from, you know, from the numbers perspective, or we can just understand that it's affecting real people. You look at the news covered by Malay Mail, there was a man, he was unemployed, he had, you know, he was undergoing some family issues, and he was fined 3,000 ringgit for attempting suicide. I mean, it's wonderful that he managed to survive, but with that kind of onslaught, it only added further pressure. And you see that the numbers, even though Malaysia's suicide rates are relatively lower than other countries, the number of those who attempt suicide are increasing year by year. So it means that criminalization of suicide doesn't make a positive difference on the people attempting it. There's a paper by Safu Fahmi. So I think it's important, again, to be evidence-based in our policymaking, as well as, you know, compassionate and empathetic. And the fact is, suicide, if you attempt it, will carry up to 1 year in prison or a fine or both, right? That's the reality. And while I'm happier that the discussion is percolating in a far more rigorous manner in comparison to 06, 08, before I became an MP, but, you know, even then, I have to admit, you know, it wasn't the main issue in everyone's minds. But now, how can you avoid it? If you talk about being a representative of the people, you hear the cries, you feel the grief, you have to bring it up, right? Regardless of your partisan stripes. So for me, I'm glad that the new minister has, you know, raised the need for decriminalization. He mentioned what it will be discussed in the select committee. But, you know, we've also lost that many, many days of parliamentary session to discuss key issues pressing all of us. I keep mentioning this, where you have to maximize every arm of our democracy, one of which is the legislative arm, to exactly do these things, because people are being affected. And you see that the close linkage in terms of their income levels with the state of mental well-being. So it really is important to understand the link between suicide and financial issues. So it's a really, really kind of deep link. So it should push governments to understand the importance of laws or you know, reforming at every level and providing sufficient social safety nets to protect the people better.
So the law that criminalizes the act of suicide is essentially, number one, penalizing those who are in need of help, in need of mental health help. Number two, you're also penalizing the poor because they tend to be the ones who are, you know, most pressured by financial difficulties, which cause, you know...
It goes back to your issue of empathy. If you're in a higher position in society, would you be able to feel that orang miskin kadang-kadang dilarang sakit? I mean, they really have a different impact in terms of how the crisis affects them.
Do you think a bill to decriminalize suicide can gain bipartisan support? I mean, it seems like such a no-brainer, yeah? It seems like such an easy thing to do. It's easy, it can be done immediately, and it feels like it's beneficial to everyone. Are there obstacles in the way?
Well, I'm sure there will be obstacles in any society. If you talk about, you know, extreme conservative outlook, so I can't speak for all the other members of parliament. I hope they will come to realize we're all in this to safeguard the sanctity of human life. We also want to help and do our bit to provide people with hope. especially in the wake of the Bendera Putih, the white flag movement, everyone understands. It's just, you know, asking Malaysians to come together, lawmakers to come together. And I'm hopeful from the statement made by the new health minister. I think he did reorient focus back to the importance of, you know, preserving and giving support, sufficient support, financial support to mental health. But again, you know, the proof of the pudding would be the passing of the law.
I'm speaking to YB Nurul Izzah Anwar, MP for Pematang Pau. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Thanks for staying tuned to the Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and to mark World Suicide Prevention Day, I'm speaking to YB Nurul Izzah Anwar, Member of Parliament for Pematang Pau. Izzah, before the break, we were talking about decriminalising suicide, and we know that this will go a long way towards decriminalising mental health issues in general. But more needs to be done for suicide prevention, in terms of putting safety mechanisms that can help relieve mental health difficulties before they reach that point of no return, yeah? And here is where I want to bring in the helpline that you introduced in Pematang Pau, the Talian Prihatin, to provide that kind of mental health support. How do you see that? What has the response been like?
It's I think people really feel they need to be listened to. They just want to feel that connection. They want to explain that, yes, they do need financial support, financial aid, but also the feeling that they're not alone in grieving, in facing all these challenges thrown at them. And we've been receiving calls, and I thank our counsellors who have been so committed, because it wasn't easy and it's not cheap, yeah?
I believe you.
To obtain support for mental health, for counselling. But yeah, we're receiving calls even from Sabah, you know, for...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so meaning like there's, it's a sort of a national predicament of sorts. Mm-hmm. So I'm encouraged because there's also groups like Talian Rahmah who've actually trained my staff members. Talian Rahmah has been providing that support for us and of course nationally as well. And this is inclusive of victims that need shelters and protection. Because, for example, if someone calls you up and they're in mortal danger, you can't just give them sweet nothings. And again, calming words is crucial, but again, you know, they do need concrete aid. But I still feel that when KKM announced they will continue adding to the existing 20 NGOs, called Talia Healthline, and this will be helpful because it's going to be an immediate needed support, yeah? So they have about a collaboration with 20 NGOs and out 20 more, funding them to offer services of mental health and improve primary health services through the use of teleconsultation at selected health clinics. Yeah, but those, you know, again, you also have to understand that even KKM frontliners are also fatigued. They themselves are going to see the increase of being infected by COVID by virtue of being exposed on a daily basis. So it has to be a symbiotic process where we take into account the different stakeholders and the support that they need. I think we also need to put the money where the mouth is. So the Ministry of Health is going to be taking on such an important role in Malaysia's overall well-being. So I believe that the cabinet and budget should also reflect this. We can't depend on our usual less than 4% of the GDP. It's not sufficient. Mm-hmm. It's not sufficient.
I think you highlight a couple of really important things. The fact that supporting mental health, it's not just a healthcare issue, but it actually covers your social welfare support. It covers a much broader net of support. In terms of policy initiatives that the government has implemented, which you've seen maybe over the past year when it comes to mental health, do you see anything that's working? What are initiatives that could be improved or strengthened?
I think we've been very lucky because we have a lot of support from the non-governmental organizations. I've learned so much from them. They have been in the forefront where they talk about Befrienders, Kuala Lumpur, you know, or even like Women's Aid Organization. They've been at the forefront, right, of saying about the need to support the vulnerable segment, the need to just, you know, give some a degree of mental health first aid. So I wish there were further steps to enable them to do their work better. How does the government, how does the environment, how does the MKN become enablers so that this sort of support, you know, psychosocial support can be delivered, yeah, by experts in a safe manner? Okay, and if you have to plug in through grants, then do so. We're not bereft of ideas. We just need to make sure that it meets the needs of the stakeholders, so stakeholder engagement. I had asked even, when you talk about the Women's Ministry, the empowerment and protection of women and children should be mainstreamed and carried out by all ministries. Because, you know, sometimes we always leave one ministry as subservient to the other. Everyone looks at the Defence Ministry and you feel, that's the most important, that's the most crucial. Well, what are your guns good for when you're facing a pandemic? You can't shoot viruses, can they? So I think it's really important then to understand, okay, in the bigger scheme of things, prioritize and specify, you know, what the NGOs are needing. And in terms of, I mean, I'm glad they're adding on 20 more in the support group, but it has to be far more holistic in nature.
So there's a lot more room for government and NGO cooperation in this sphere. Do you think the pandemic has allowed for more meaningful policy debate on what constitutes mental health and what a strong mental health system looks like? Or are we still in the creating awareness stage where it's about getting people to realize that mental health is an issue?
Well, I believe if we had the opportunity to hold parliamentary sessions, we could have unearthed and deepened the debate further rather than the usual, because, you know, we're always restarting, right? Restarting mode again and again. And I believe it's also important for the government of the day to build some degree of trust rather than allow for the deficit to run on for some time. Because if you want support from different stakeholders, then you have to provide a degree of credibility in policymaking, in governance. And this is going to be showcased through this leadership by example action, where everyone will be applied the same rules, no one is exempted, and that will help, you know, cajole and an understanding along a particular continuum towards reforms. So for me, if you look at the state of affairs, yes, it is really ripe for us to revamp what needs to be changed. You know, you hear this from the discussions brought up by Mazzucato, even local economists, you know, Muhammad Aslam. So many people are saying, this is the time not just to take piecemeal measures. It's not just about, okay, we're going to add a couple of billion here and there. But you have to look at the flaws in our system, right? Only 1% of Malaysian healthcare expenditure is covered by social insurance schemes. But you look at Germany, where they can have up to, what, 80 to 90% covered in terms of people's medical bills. I'm not saying we can jump straight away, but we have to at least plug in the deficiencies now. And this debate have to showcase that the government should be leading in this kind of a reform-oriented approach and focusing on, you know, prioritizing the vulnerable segment.
One of the most worrying trends that has come out of the pandemic is the increasing incidence of depression, you know, suicide attempts and other mental health issues among children and young adults. You spoke earlier about making mental health a more prominent feature in the education system. I mean, how do you think we should go about doing that?
You know, we look at the National Health and Mobility Survey. This was in 2019. There were about 424,000. And I repeat this, 424,000 children in Malaysia experiencing mental health problems. This is about 8% of children aged 5 to 15. I have one, she's going to be 14 soon, and I have one 12-year-old. And I mean, it hits home, right? Because all you want is for your children to be, I mean, resilient, because you can only impart values, and then they will have to continue their lives even after you're long gone. And for many families who are orphaned because parents are succumbed to COVID. So mental health literacy then becomes one of the key ways, their first aids, if you can term it, to correctly identify and respond to the challenges and the pressures that come. So this sort of program is only organized at universities and private education institutions. But how about even like, you know, primary levels, right now. What do you do when you feel down? What do you do when you're stuck in at home and you can't see your friends? So this kind of emotional resilient type of lessons, I think, is important. It can be further simplified. We can look at how psychological first aid in crisis taking place in war zones. And we've been very lucky to live in a time of peace, but it's, again, the pandemic is in a way a sort of war.
Okay, Isa, you have so many ideas. You know, you're brimming with recommendations or policies that could be implemented, ways for different stakeholders to cooperate. Why not take a prominent post that would give you more leverage to influence policy decision-making, given all these ideas that you have?
Well, I think in the opposition, we are doing our best. You know, a lot of my colleagues and I, we are pushing very hard for legal reforms, because if you talk about a more prominent role, it certainly will be set by the government of the day. They have a new cabinet, and I do hope that they will include most of the key suggestions that we brought forward, because I feel very strongly that we're not implementing future-proof policies as we should. There's a few initiatives that has been developed by University Malaya, mainly in the issue of cervical cancer clinical trials. So yes, I'm doing that behind the scenes, things that I haven't been able to focus and learn about when I was busy in my campaigning and electioneering postings. So in a way, I think those are the things that need to be mainstreamed further. So these are the things I'm working on behind mm-hmm. the scenes, including the new measurement of poverty post-COVID. And I hope that it can be perhaps translated into, in a more vocal manner. But it's important to do your homework too, you know. It's important to sort of have reach on the ground, because there's so many talents, you know, within Malaysia, but we do need to empower them as well, because we have been empowering politicians a little too much. And we need to be empowering the right talents to push and spearhead Malaysia mm-hmm. forward.
Will you be defending your seat in GE15?
Well, if the party decides to, it's still early days. For now, we're all battling COVID-19. And it's multifaceted variants. Yes, let's you know, I really care so much about Perumahan Pau. I love that we're doing the pilots there and we're continuing to do our work. But of course, when the next elections hits us all, I guess it would be nice to defend my seat. But again, it's still early days.
Okay, we hope to have you back on before then, you know, to talk more about this. But last question, Isa, before I let you go, you're no strangers to pressure in every sphere. I imagine the situation is exacerbated because you're always in the spotlight. So how do you cope with mental health difficulties? I mean, what has helped you find your equilibrium, and what tips would you have to share with people?
I think, Shazana, you know, everybody feels that, oh, I've been there, done that, I can take this. But when push comes to shove, when you're dealing with something that's beyond any expectations, and, I always tell my kids, it's like a growth mindset, right? You're always growing and you can never underestimate how strong you can become from day to day. So, you know, I always, you know, we grew up with this notion, false notion, that the heart is the organ of fire. It is not. It is the mind. Our brain, that is the organ of fire, because the mind is extremely powerful. So no matter what life throws at you, you're able to control it by virtue of controlling your mind. And I think what's most important is, like for me, it's of course that deep connection to spirituality, a healthy dose of mindfulness. The two loves of my life, my children. I've been so fortunate and blessed. And I think that keeps me going. And of course, to add value, right? What's life? You can't keep adding value to it. So you just have to to kind of the skeletal form of strength is really just counting on blessings every day. And I do that.
And that's a great way to end our discussion on mental health, Iza. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and on that note, I've been speaking to YB Nurul Iza, Member of Parliament for Pematang Pau. This has been The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.